Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown, one of the big conversations that has dominated the news here in Alberta. Has had to do with the Alberta strategy, or as the UCP government like to call it, the Alberta model, of managing the opioid crisis, managing the deaths that are stemming from the opioid crisis, and that broadens into a much larger conversation on addictions and the mental health piece. Now, there have been a lot of people who have widely criticized the Alberta model because it seems to be modeled maybe not so much on the evidence, maybe not so much on things that have been proven to work, and more on things that have been proven to not work. And it's predicated largely on the design of an individual who is the chief of staff to the Premier, Danielle Smith, Marshall Smith. Today, we're going to try to put a little bit of a different angle on it. We're going to try to get a little bit of another perspective and hopefully perhaps inform the conversation a little bit more in regards to what harm reduction means, what it should be doing, and why it's being misrepresented potentially by the Premier of Alberta. To do that, we're very excited, after multiple attempts, which are entirely my fault, to be joined today by a harm reduction advocate who has an incredible story of lived experience, Guy Felicella. Guy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
And again, I just want to sort of publicly say thanks again for being willing to reschedule after I screwed up, like, I don't know how many times.
Just once.
Well, then that's good. That's pretty good for me. Before we get into the broader conversation about what harm reduction means to you, what the principles of harm reduction are, how they should inform policy, all of that stuff, I want to hear, if you don't mind, if you could tell our listeners and our viewers what's this, and take as much time as you need, man. I want to be clear about that. What's the story of Guy Felicella? How did you come to be, in many ways, at the forefront of the conversation on harm reduction, not just in British Columbia, but in Canada?
I guess, I always say with lived experience, you can't buy it, but it sure does cost a lot. You know, it's one of those things that, that I struggled. I mean, I had, at an early age, challenges, dysfunctionalism in my household, was around a lot of, verbal abuse and seeing things that, not every young kid any kid should see ever. There was alcoholism and, for me, it developed my, anxiety and depression and led to self-hatred. I struggled in school. It was called hyper difficult and hard to manage. I wasn't, I was struggling with undiagnosed learning disabilities that weren't noted until way later on in my life. And, so you carry all this immense shame and, you're here constantly. I always said that verbally, the negativity that happens when a young kid's mind's forming is that you hear negative stuff about yourself, that, what's wrong with you, or, why would you do that? And, you start to form this negativity towards yourself. And, as a young kid, I'd thought about ending my life. And, the challenges of being in a household, I just basically got to a point in my life where, I needed a distraction from that. And so at 12 years old, I mean, I drank alcohol, I think it was like at 8. And I threw up everywhere. I didn't like it at all. But I think the association with alcohol in my life is that I've never liked it because I witnessed somebody struggle with it throughout my life. And so, that wasn't it. And then when I was 12, I found, street drugs. And that really, changed the trajectory of my life. First off, it becomes one of those things where I started running away from home. I started getting involved with gangs very early. These people were much older than me. Here I am 12 and these kids are 18 to 20 years old. And, even though people would say that these gangs are grooming you, I will tell you this, that if kids aren't being accepted in their own, environment that they're growing up in, guess what? They'll look for that elsewhere. And to me, I couldn't care less because they treated me like I was somebody. And that was comforting. But I had gotten to a place in my life at a young age where I was, I didn't care if I died. And so the interesting thing that I've always looked upon or looked back on is the drugs that were going to save my life were one day going to turn into the drugs that were going to one day try to end my life. And at a young age of 12 years old, you don't understand that, nor do you care, because you're just trying to feel, somewhat normal. And it did. And, I didn't care after I was using drugs what anybody said about me anymore. And then obviously with the level of enforcement that comes with being with involved with gangs is just a whole other level that I couldn't comprehend. And by the time I was 14, I was incarcerated in juvenile detention for a year. I was made a ward of the court. While I was made a ward of the court, I heard my mom come in and just basically say that, all the issues that are happening are because of guys just uncontrollable. And when you hear that, you kind of get everything placed onto you. And I just remember, feeling a sense of, sadness. Then, I knew how to survive my household. I was so scared being incarcerated because I didn't know that environment. But once I'd gotten used to that, it became something that was familiar. And even after finishing my sentence, and going being bounced around from group home to group home, and I just started to venture into the downtown east side of Vancouver at a really young age, and and the drugs got harder, got faster, and eventually, it basically succumbed to a two block radius for decades. But what I was always doing is, I'd gone through treatment facilities as a youth. I'd gone through, work camp programs as well, where, they try to beat you in shape because, you're a lazy drug user is how they used to describe me back then, you go in and you can do the program. I was always good at doing programs, and I'd always say this to people, it was easy to get sober. It was hard to stay sober. And when you're not dealing with, demons of the past, and nor did I care. I wasn't a social drug user either. I didn't need drugs to be social. I was a, let's get wasted drug user. So, big difference. I'm not, did I ever enjoy it? Sure. I guess obviously it did something. It was the payoff, that made me feel like I could function through life with it. And it did help me function. The downtown east side of Vancouver, when I first encountered it was even before I was incarcerated. I used to go and score dope down there and leave and, or hang out in East Van, go to the P&E, like do kid stuff. That's what we do. We get high and go to the P&E and, drop LSD and, go on the roller coaster all day and just that kind of stuff, nothing too dramatic. And then, quickly after that, especially in that area too, there wasn't much on the cocaine or the heroin front back then. It was more all pills. And it's always been a pill and a booze was really predominant in that community back then. And I'd score some dope here and there and started getting involved with cocaine from a guy actually in the UBC area, so it wasn't in the downtown east side. And once I started doing that, it just became a whole other level. And the interesting thing where I always described about the downtown east side of Vancouver is that I'd always felt like I wasn't being judged for how I was living my life by the community, which was really interesting because I was being judged everywhere else. Like everywhere else, people were trying to analyze me. Psychiatrists, were poking and prodding every time they could, get me into one of their facilities. I found it, I found them very disingenuous and untrustworthy. And I wasn't going to tell them anything because once I told them stuff about my past, it really came back to bite me. And then they put you on all these psych meds and they just make you even worse. And so the street drugs worked, the psych meds didn't. And they kept trying all these combinations. And eventually I just kind of just flew away from everybody, including myself. And when I'd gotten into that community, I found the beauty of being familiar with surrounding myself with other people who are struggling with the same things that I was, which to me was somewhat therapeutic, even though I wasn't getting better. But the feeling of being connected to other people's pain was really interesting in my life. And then, from there, it just continued to progress. Obviously, once I always say, you get involved with the criminal justice system, and that becomes just this revolving door of incarceration, parole, red zone violations. And my life just kind of went that way. And by the time I was, 16, I was into heroin and cocaine. And then, I had a few good years where, I was, doing okay, trying to do what society's norms, would be like, trying to figure it out, get a job, get a paycheck, which, I held down a couple jobs here and there and, trying so hard to not use drugs, but I just couldn't figure out why I kept using them. And, eventually it led me on a couple decades run of the in the 2 block radius of Vancouver, where I just basically became engulfed in addiction. And I survived the HIV crisis in the 90s, where 1 in 4 had contracted HIV AIDS in the downtown east side. You survived that, and I survived that overdose crisis in the 90s as well, where a lot of my friends had died. A lot of my friends died of HIV. I'd survived, basically, 22 years sleeping in doorways, stairwells, parkades, sidewalk, wherever I could find, shelter, survive. Then I'd gotten all these other health complications, 5 osteomyelitis, bone infections, 4 in my left leg, 1 in my back, where I had to, learn how to walk again. And then in 2012 and 2013, I just started overdosing. I had to be brought back to life multiple times, 6 times in that 9 month time frame. And it just, was so, I just remember the last overdose, which February 18th, 2013, is just, it just, I was gone for so long. And just, I remember getting up and looking over to the left of me, and the nurse had tears in her eyes and basically asked, like, why are you crying? And she just said, because I care. And I mean, I just lost it and I started to cry. And I knew, I just knew, I mean, pain taught me something. That experience taught me something, and it taught me 2 things I knew were going to happen in my life. I wasn't going to live much longer, and I was either going to die in my addiction, or I was going to die trying to get out. And I'd been to, in and out of treatment, listen, my whole life, like we're talking over a dozen times, in and out. I don't even know how many times I've been in detox. I don't know how many years I've spent in hospital beds, staying there to be, brought back to health. My body has been stitched up from head to toe. There's just scars like everywhere. And I mean it, the punishment, not only from how I was living or how policy was making me live, but I was trying, man. And I don't think people cared that I was trying. And because I wasn't successful. And or successful in their eyes of not using drugs again. And I even thought I was such a failure because I couldn't stay sober. So I failed my whole life at everything. And now I can't even do this, and my life depends on it. But before my last overdose, it was a few years before that, where Gabor Maté was my doctor in the downtown east side of Vancouver. And I'll never forget it. where he just, walked in one day and asked, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Are you enjoying yourself?" And I said, "Hell no, this just, my life sucks." And he says, "You know what, guy? I think there's a re I don't think drugs are really your problem. I think there's a reason why you use them the way you do." And nobody had ever said that to me. In my eyes, I said, first, I remember just saying, everybody says it's the drugs. And what was interesting is he said, "Tell me about your childhood." And the funny thing about trauma is that I suppressed it so deep that I wouldn't even look at it. I mean, I no wonder I was using drugs the way I was. And I just started to cry. And then after that, I was diagnosed with ADHD, which I started to cry again when I found out that I had ADHD because I'd always felt stupid my whole life. I never shared that with anybody. I was always in school. I was put in the cubicle. When I went to school, I was often, I couldn't bring in my homework because I didn't know how to do it. And people were like, "What's wrong with you?" I was like, I don't know. So having that knowledge and then understanding there was a deep-rooted, painful past that I'd been suppressing with the substances. And it's interesting because I was just did a segment with Gabor about 2 months ago where I actually brought it up. And you know what he said? "What's shocking is not what I said. It's what's shocking that no psychiatrist or addiction specialist had ever said that to you before." And so everybody's just trying to get you off drugs, but you get off drugs and your life becomes even more painful. So you keep going back to the drugs. And, I had success. I had, 9 months here, 1 year here. I go to prison, I wouldn't use drugs, I'd go on a health kick. I was a strong-willed person with a lot of grit and a lot of perseverance. I was always trying. I could thrive in a structured program. You throw me in any recovery program, I could do it. I just couldn't do life. And once I'd started putting all the pieces together of why I use these things the way that I do and had counseling support, trauma therapy was a big thing. Once I'd done and understood all these things about my past and was and became a willing participant to deal with it. This is the thing. I became more willing to focus on dealing with that than I was the life that I was living. And there was two things. I was either gonna go to prison for the rest of my life, or I was gonna die, or I was gonna recover. And I bet the farm, and I can remember, I left the downtown east side of Vancouver with one set of clothes on my back and a welfare check. Nothing. I had absolutely nothing. And I went to a run-of-the-mill recovery house, which when I say run-of-the-mill, I mean it was like, here's the rules. You do a chore, you got to do group in the morning, and you got to do a meeting at night. And I was involved in another outpatient program outside of the recovery house. And that was it. The guy that ran it was great. He just told me, and he knew me for many years. And he said, "I'll kick you out if you use drugs. So if you can just, I committed to that. So it was an agreement. Okay, I'm not gonna." And I was on methadone for 9 months, which kept me from being so hell-bent on using street drugs. And especially, I just said I was either going to die in my addiction or I was going to die trying to get the hell out. And so let's die trying. Lay it all on the table, guy. And if you don't make it, at least you gave it your best shot. Wherever you go after that, you can say to yourself, "Hey, man, like I worked hard to do it. It didn't work. I didn't get the result I was looking for, but I gave it a go. And look, it worked out." So, yeah, that's kind of the story in a somewhat compartmentalized way.
Okay. I want to ask you, I mean, you brought up a couple of things there that I want to explore a little bit, if that's okay with you. You spent an incredible amount of time on the downtown east side. And one of the things that we've seen discussed over and over and over again is, I mean, it's been the focus of garbage documentaries, who I won't name because legal reasons and stuff, but there's been a lot of conversation around, oh, the downtown east side, it shows how bad drugs can be. But there's been a lot of people who have argued that it's a lot more complicated than that. And I'm curious, I mean, I remember in the 90s You said the one thing about how you would go down to the East Side and you would feel like you weren't being judged. And I remember in the 90s and the early 2000s, I used to go down to East Hastings, and I used to go down to Granville Street. Was a very different place. it was a given that if I went down to Granville, I'd see somebody get hit by a car and then get back up and walk away. That was like the tradition of the trips to Vancouver. But there's a lot of people who argue that there was a major, major shift that occurred in the early 2000s, particularly around 2005, 2007. And that's when the mental health system in BC really started to fail a lot of the people in their care. With the closure of Riverview Hospital, there were people who had complex, had required inpatient care, mental health stuffs going on, and they were basically dumped into low rent apartments in the downtown East Side. I'm curious, do you think that, in your experience, do you think that contributed to the increasing severity of the situation in the downtown East Side? Did you see any of that when you were down there? Because, I mean, I've only read the stories in my anecdotal experience.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's people down there that have complex mental health needs, right? You know, honestly, you know, in my whole time down there, I mean, I knew a lot of people that acted out of character, but honestly, they were really harmless to me, you know, or really to a lot of others. I mean, they were more of, you know, somewhat dealing with their own mental health struggles. And then I guess the compounding issue with that as well is the substances that they're using. And then you got to factor in some sleep debt on top of that. And, you know, there's a combination of things that go into it that can make anybody who's even doesn't have mental health issues have mental health issues, right? Like, you know, try staying up for, I mean, I used to stay up for weeks on end, and I'm telling you, man, like my body became uncontrollable. I never really slept. I'd say I'd just collapse. And did the area get worse? You know what, to me, I think, you know, what has gotten worse down there is that, obviously the drugs, have gotten, there's no question the toxicity level of the substances with benzos and everything else that has completely gotten worse. What else has gotten worse is there's a housing crisis. And, you know, there's nowhere for people to go. And I'll tell you something, you know, being homeless for people, the focus is mentally and physically a punishing condition. It is not, you know, and then you have all these people who want now to say that, well, there's an addiction issue here. And maybe so. I'm not going to dispute that. A lot of people who are homeless are struggling with an addiction. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that they don't deserve housing because they're not addressing other issues. So you can't tell somebody, go get treatment. And a lot of people in the downtown East Side or anywhere have tried treatment, right? And, you know, oftentimes, you know, treatment takes, it's a journey. And you going in and getting it and coming out, like, you know, never using substance again is so rare. I think you could buy the Lotto Max and have a better shot at winning that than actually, you know, getting better. So you go back to what's familiar for whatever reason. You know, a lot of the times too, when you're immersed in a community, especially, listen, it's a lot easier for a lot of people to recover depending on what they had before they started falling into addiction. So let's say you had a job, you had a house, you had a career, right? And you lost it all. You had support, all that, and you lost it all. You went into the downtown side. You know, it is easier for you to get those things back than it is easy for somebody that's never had any of that in their lives. And when you haven't had anything, let me tell you this, man. It has probably been the most physically and mentally challenging thing I've ever had to battle to get anywhere. I'm still going to be criminalized for my past. People are still going to say he broke the law. People are going to still say, well, yeah, you used drugs for more than, 31 years of your life and cost us taxpayers. Maybe you should start paying that back now. I'm serious. These are the people in our society. How is that like an environment that's, supportive to somebody? Or you go into treatment and they don't allow you to be on methadone or Suboxone, or they want to taper you off of it. I mean, here's the thing is that if it's a requirement to go into a facility to be on nothing or not have any medications, I don't agree with that. I think if you go into a facility, you should be on whatever medication you need to actually get through it. Because listen, let me tell you, I wasn't in withdrawal for a week. I was withdrawing for like 60 to 90 days. Like this is, I mean, I couldn't sleep for the first 35 days. Like I'd pass out a couple hours here, a couple hours there. Sore body, sore joints, you're dealing with that. How are you going to function through treatment? So that community, is very resilient. And there's a lot of people been down there struggling for a long time. And guess what? The biggest challenge too is that they don't have housing. And I will tell you this, I'd gotten a friend of mine, I worked hard to get her housing when I was an outreach worker down there, and we finally got her housing. And this is what she said to me, and it really rang true. It was, guy had 99 problems, and who'd have thought getting housing would solve 90 of them? And now I can work on dealing with the other nine. When she said that to me, man, I was like, God, that's beautiful. And so you see, like, for us to say to people, you have to go to treatment. Sure, treatment's, a lot of people need to go to treatment. But really how treatment becomes successful is that you want to be there. And if you can't even, if you don't have somebody, a willing participant to go through treatment, then I'm going to tell you this, the chances of it being a successful treatment attempt will be slim to none. Plus, being in an environment that you don't want to be in with other people that are wanting to be there, how is that going to mesh well when you're, I would have a bad attitude and be like, yeah, kick me out. I don't want to stay here. You force me into treatment, I'd be like, no. Like, I'm not going. So you're going to have all these, circumstances. So, recovery is really about somebody that wants it, and making somebody want it, it has to be attractive. People, that's what I was attracted to people. I was inspired by people that got out of the downtown East Side and I saw them sober. I couldn't believe it. And I'd known their life. I was like, you've been down here as long as me. How the heck did you get out? And you pick up stories like that. You know what? There's no, I see people taking shots at the downtown East Side all the time. And a lot of them from recovery groups. But I don't see them down there ever handing out sandwiches or coffee or meeting the community and talking to them that recovery exists. If they want to come, here's my card. Give me a call. I'll come down here and grab you. I don't see any of that. But you sure see people pointing fingers or coming down there with a camera crew to do a documentary or whatever. But there's just no connection to the community. When I'm down there, people don't ask me for drugs or can you get any safer supply or can you help me see this or that. Oh, they want to go to detox or they want to get help. So there's people looking, people searching, people trying. I don't think we celebrate that enough. There's a lot of people down there that are trying and want a better life. It's just our challenges are is that we don't support them.
One of the things that I could vision some of the people that are responsible for drug policy in Alberta responding with is, well, that's why you can't have housing first. And I mean, it's fascinating to me because I've had conversations with people who do outreach here in Calgary. I've had conversations with people who do work to address the homeless and the houseless issues here in Calgary. And I haven't heard from anybody who's on the street level, I haven't heard anybody say, oh, you got to use the housing as bait. You got to use it as bait and say, hey, if you go do this program, if you stay sober for X amount of time, then we'll get you housing. Everybody says, no, it has to be housing first. So like you said, you take away those 90 problems and then the nine become manageable. What is your response when you hear politicians and pundits saying things like, we shouldn't be giving them housing until they're sober because they don't deserve it, or they're just going to wreck it, or?
Well, I'd say that's the incorrect assumption. And you know what? If that's the excuse, which I hear a lot, they're going to destroy it. Well, then build one out of concrete. There's one downtown. It's all built. I'm serious. It's built out of concrete. So everything is confined to a, you know, it's a nice place. I mean, these rooms are gorgeous, but it's just all concrete. So it's got a kitchen, it's got a stove, it's got all that. So if a fire breaks out, it can't go anywhere. You know, so it's contained. So that's how you solve that. You got sprinklers. Yeah, you know, you got to put stuff in there to protect people, right? Air conditioning, obviously. You know, make it comfortable. You know, you do that. You offer people housing. The other thing too is this is that, you know, why would anybody want to go to treatment just to know that they won't have housing at the end of it? Or that there's the remote chance that they will. People have already probably gone and used through treatment themselves already. And you know what? I think that the approach that happens in Alberta, hey, listen, you can build a recovery systems of care. This is not, there's not, I'm never against any of that. What I am against is if it goes at the expense of harm reduction, or that there's an attack on harm reduction where you start to say that it's enabling, because the reality is and the truth is that I wouldn't be alive today if that supervised consumption site didn't exist. I wouldn't have survived all those life-threatening infections if it wasn't for harm reduction. You know, I wouldn't have over a decade sober today and a family and a career job and you know, be able to do talks in high schools, universities, and galas and speak across the country, not only just the country, the world. Like I wouldn't, none of it would exist. And I think where the challenge is that we haven't developed a fully continuum systems of care, which meets the needs of people who are using drugs on the ground, right? Because how can you say to somebody who's using drugs, here, we'll support you in recovery, but if you go back to using drugs again, well, hey, guess what? Like you're at supreme risk of death, but we don't care. We're not going to help you there either. You know, you have to have both. And I've been saying this for years. I'm like, man, can't anybody see it? Oh no, harm reduction enables people to continue using. I was already using before I ever walked into any harm reduction facility. You know, or handing me a clean syringe didn't stop, handing me no syringe didn't stop me from using. I picked one up off the ground and grabbed some bleach, or I broke into the hospital and I stole some from the hospital storeroom. You know, we're talking back in, I've been incarcerated for drug paraphernalia, never mind dope. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, this is how they treated substance users. No, punish them. And guess what? Prison isn't about rehabilitation, it's about incarceration. And then guess what? When you drop me off after prison, I'm standing at a bus stop homeless with a welfare check. Gee, thanks. You know, and you wonder why it's a revolving door. I got to go back to how what I know how to survive. That's the thing. You know, sadly in today's day and age, people ain't going to survive on the street that long because of the drug supply. And so what we've done is your whole life revolves around surviving while you're homeless. Right? You can't even go to sleep. You sleep with one eye open. You know, you don't want to go to a shelter. What if you're have some, you know, you have beefs on the street. You can't be in a shelter. It locks you down into an area. People know where you are. Yeah, man. Like, you know, people get abused in, you know, in shelters. Shelters create the illusion that we're actually doing something. They don't give people housing.
I want to, I mean, you talked about harm reduction. You talked about the importance of harm reduction. It's a poorly understood term. Before I say anything, what is harm reduction to you? How would you define harm reduction for somebody who has never heard of it and they hear that, wait, you want to give people drugs? You want to give people poison? Explain to somebody like that what harm reduction is.
Harm reduction is really just a, you know, a response to understanding that a person is using substances, whether we like it or not. And we need these services in place to reduce the harms of those substances that the person is using. That's, you know, really how harm reduction works. Like, it's non-judgmental, right? Like, this is the thing, is that I remember when, Liz Evans started the Portland Housing Society, which is really when harm reduction started taking shape in the downtown east side of Vancouver in the early 90s. And I just remember a nurse walking up to me and handing me a syringe. And I actually said, "Well, I know, how much are you charging?" And she was just like, "No, I'm giving it to you." Because, and I was like, "Why?" And she says, "Guy, because you deserve to, not pick up one off the ground and get HIV or Hep C. And, I understand you're gonna do drugs anyway, regardless what I do. Telling me not to do them never stopped me from doing them." And so it's, kind of that safety net. It's like, okay, hey, listen, we already have people using substances, so let's support them. And you know what? Like, every time, people often say this, "Oh yeah, but they don't push the continuum of care, or they don't tell people about recovery." This is so false, because in InSite at the detox facility, they have, so the injection site on the bottom floor, they have a detox on the second floor. Like, there's two lines. People often just assume when people are going into the injection site, "Oh, they're going in to inject drugs." Well, you don't know that. They could be going upstairs into the detox floor. It's packed. It's packed today. It's always full. There's always people. It's such a harm reduction is such a relationship building with people, to know where they're at and to let them know what other services are available. I mean, the great thing that happened in my life is that they were always encouraging me, like, "Hey, guy, do you want to take a break? If you do, like, we have the detox floor upstairs." That was a constant reminder when guy just was breaking down and not doing well, and people would see me and offer me, like, "Hey, like, why don't you just—" Nobody is saying go get off drugs. They were saying just go take a break. And I take these breaks, and all of a sudden, after a couple of weeks, I'd start gaining some momentum, feeling good, getting my health back, stay sober for three months, and start using again, and go back to the injection site. And all the times that I left treatment, and I tell you, I was carried a lot of shame every time I wasn't successful at treatment as well, just because of how people judge you in treatment. And I tell you, I was using outside. I wouldn't go back to the injection site because they worked hard to get me into treatment, and I stayed sober. I think it was like 3.5 months this time. And I felt so much, because they worked so hard to help me. I felt like I let everybody down. And I remember I was using drugs in Chinatown, and a nurse that saw me came up to the bench, and she's like, "Guy, what are you doing?" I'll never forget it. I said, "Oh, I felt like I let you guys down." She said, "Guy, I don't care if you use drugs, man. I just don't want you to die from them, man. Come back. Like, we're all missed you. We all were asking, like, has anybody seen you?" We could hear people saying that they seen you around in the community. And I was like, "Really?" I came back, man. And luckily I did, because I'd overdosed a couple more times in that facility after that. Like, I mean, so the reality is that it builds a relationship with people, gives people the available options that exist. Like, if you walked into a harm reduction facility, I'll even tell you this, if you walked into VANDU, which is a drug user organization, and asked for help to go to a detox facility, what do you think they would say? "No, we don't do that here. We only support people that use drugs." Nonsense. They would be the ones on the phone advocating at Vancouver Coastal Health, say, "Help this guy. He needs to go in. He needs to go in now." And you know what? People just don't ever talk about those stories. But the reality is that if somebody wants help, wants, right, there's places that they can reach out. Is it quick enough? Is it timely enough? Of course not. Is that something we can do better on? Yeah, 100%. But we can't go all in on a recovery model at the expense of harm reduction, because it will be a disaster of epic proportions. And as you know, Alberta, or anywhere across the province or the country, there's nobody doing good. We all suck, because there's far too many people dying. And it isn't because of harm reduction, and it isn't because of recovery. It's because there's a poison drug supply that's out there that's crippling the nation. And until we actually make some bold decisions to give people options outside of that toxic drug crisis, such as safer substances, and drugs aren't safe, right? I don't dispute that. But there are safer alternatives to what people are using. And if people know what they're consuming, whether that's fentanyl, heroin, or whatever, they know the amount of substance that they can put in their body, and anything above that, it's a risk. It's kind of like if you go to the pharmacy and it says take two, and Nate takes six. Well, guess what? You might overdose. So don't take six, take two.
I mean, to me, the argument, and I'd like to talk about the safe supply piece for a sec. To me, the argument against safe supply is you've got a group of people that are going to drive 30 kilometers per hour over the speed limit, no matter what. And the question is, well, do we want to give them seat belts and maybe not put them on roads covered with spike belts and razor blades? Or do we want to take away their seat belts, not give them access to seat belts, and put them on these extraordinarily dangerous roads? No matter what you do, until they're ready to make the decision for themselves, they have that moment of epiphany that you talked about earlier, they're still going to drive at 130 kilometers an hour. It's just a question of how can we make it the safest 130 kilometers an hour that we possibly can. Why do you think there's so much resistance to the safe supply conversation? I mean, I know that there's been anecdotal, is the term I'll use, media reporting about diversion of some of the safe supply that has been trialed in some parts of the country. The data doesn't seem to support that there's been any deaths because of any diversion, but do with that what you will. But why do you think there's so much resistance to safe supply, and how do you see a pathway to overcoming it?
Well, I think you have one side of it that believes it's enabling people to continue living the life that they're living, right? It's continuing or enabling addiction or creating more addiction. What the truth is that the toxic drug supply is just doing that in itself, right? Not only is it creating, it's killing people, but it's also with benzos and xylazine and other substances and additives going in. It's far more dangerous than hydromorphone, heroin, or even in some programs here. Well, there's one in program, there's a fentanyl program in British Columbia where people can go in and they know exactly the amount that they're consuming. They've been titrated up to the proper dose that works for them. They come in and they use it in their facility. Away they go throughout their day. They come back, they do another one. That's, we have to understand that, for them, that's working. And if the substances aren't working for people, it's because, you know what, like the drug crisis that's out there is, it's like throwing chiclets at a raging grizzly bear. It's not going to really, and I don't think when you hear the words safer supply, there's different components of it, of when you look at it, of where people are at. Like I believe too, where person's social determinants of health are addressed and they want to stop using substances, right? Where they are in their lives can really play a motivating factor. So like for me, for instance, when I went into treatment, I was on methadone for 9 months, so I wasn't so hell-bent to think. I mean, my whole life revolved around using drugs. It would not be normal for me to not think about using drugs every day. Like that is the normal reality of somebody that uses them consistently for a long time. So when I had the ability to start dealing with all the underlying issues, and I was ready to, being on methadone really helped me have start gaining some confidence, but and some fi finding some purpose in my life. Now, for people who there's people that aren't even there. So you have people that are consistently just using the street substances, right? And this is where the huge risk is. So why wouldn't we give them something safer than what's available on the street and at least start building a relationship with them. Because I'll tell you this, the ones that are out homeless and hidden in alcoves, doorways, who's talking to them? There's no place for them to go, so they just continue doing. You know what? That's why there's a relationship with people's drug dealers. Right? They don't have any barriers. They'll just sell the drugs. The unfortunate thing is that, you know, they don't know what they're selling all the time either. And the sad thing is that we've lost far too many people, you know, every single day in across Canada. And you can't expect, if you understand, you ask anybody in recovery, how often does it take for somebody to go through treatment where they don't use drugs again? And they can't give you an answer. Could be one, could be 30. So what happens in between that when they go back and use substances again? They die. And I've known a lot of people who have gone into treatment, left treatment, the day they got out, came back, used again, and sadly are no longer alive.
I'm curious, if you're not comfortable asking totally or answering, totally understood. You mentioned that you had multiple overdoses in your lifetime. How many of those, as an approximation, would you say were overdoses with the intention of ending your life?
None.
Do you think that's something more people need to hear? Because, I mean, you had multiple overdoses, and they were never with the intention of, I'm going to overdose, and that's going to be the end of things. They were all, I'm going to hazard surprises to you. Could some of those overdoses, if not all of them, have been prevented if you had access to some sort of supply that wasn't toxic, that wasn't inconsistently measured, all of that stuff? Do you think that should be part of the conversation?
Well, especially so when I had stopped using drugs in 2013, in 2012, there was 5% of the overdose deaths that happened in 2012 were fentanyl. This is in 2012. And I'd never overdosed once up until 2012 and 2013, where I was actively purchasing this new heroin that came on the street. It was called Pebbles back in the day. And it was so potent and so powerful. And I was using that. And when I first, the first overdose that occurred, I mean, I literally couldn't believe it. And then honestly, back then, I knew the person that I'd bought it off of, and I was like, well, I'm supposed to just stay away from getting that stuff. So, you know, here's another false thing that a lot of people think, that drug users want to use the strongest stuff all the time. No, I wanted to be well. I didn't need that. Like, me seeking euphoria, I would get that through stimulants. But when it came to me using heroin, I didn't care. I just didn't want to go through the sickness. And so in order for people to understand that, I needed heroin. The heroin actually made me function and have the ability to walk around and do things and socialize and feel part of something. I didn't need to get dropped dead. I didn't want to be sitting on a sidewalk all day. This is the reality today. People don't want to do that either. The drugs are so saturated with toxins that's it. I see people, they get up, they do dope, they sit there, they don't do anything, then they get up again and do more dope. And I'm like, you know, I mean, it's sad. And so we haven't done anything significantly to remove people from that. The safer supply programs that you hear that exist in British Columbia, it's kind of like a somewhat of a myth, because people think we're handing out drugs for days to people, but this is not true. There's about 4,800 people who are getting just hydromorphone, which out of over 100,000 people who have a diagnosed opioid use disorder, I mean, it's really like we're not really handing anybody any safer supply. Like, come on, people. So, they've driven this narrative that's incorrect. There's not everybody getting it. There's no free drugs. Somebody tell me where the free drugs are, because I probably could send a bunch of people there that really need some. So there's none of that. So you know what it is too? It's political opportunism. It's sad, man. I seen it happen in the 90s with HIV/AIDS. This has become political agendas where people are just vying for power. And when you're vying for power, you really couldn't care. There's going to be lives lost, but it's all about getting those votes, getting elected, doing your thing. And guess what? As long as we remain divided, or we don't have both harm reduction and recovery, then we're going to continue to pass this on to generation until somebody, hopefully the generation in the rearview mirror, stands up and says, and I'm sure one day that the federal government will have to get up like they've always done after they've committed atrocities and say, like, hey, you know what? We dropped the ball. We allowed so many people to die for so long before we actually did something significant. And you can't tell people that their only option is recovery, or we don't support you, or we're not going to give you safer substances. We couldn't care less. Then you know what? You wonder why people wouldn't want to go to treatment either. It's because of how they're treated. And also, too, it's the only treatment industry that I know, recovery treatment, where they say, hey, listen, we're going to focus on you for 3 months to get you off the drugs. What happens after that? Like, who's get can I am I going to get a job? Well, we'll see what happens. What about housing? That might be a possibility. We'll work on it. What about trauma counseling? Not here. No, we got a drug and alcohol counselor you can talk to, though. Yeah, but I don't want to talk to somebody here. What about being on methadone or Suboxone? Well, we don't really do that here because you're not really sober if you're on those medications. So no, so it's an environment that's not attractive to people. Or, you have a lot of money, I can get you into treatment. You don't have money and it's harder. I know Alberta says that they've done stuff to alleviate a lot of that. I don't know the extent, but I will tell you this. I've sent people from BC to Alberta to go to treatment, but also people from Alberta have called me wanting to come to BC to do treatment. So, I see it. I see it all the time. I just really don't, here, this is the thing. I don't care if somebody's using drugs. I just don't want them to die. And you know what? It took me, I'll never, I walk, hey, listen, I tell you, I can't walk too long. My leg will get sore. My back will get sore. I mean, that is physically, I'm in shape, but I'm still reminded of a past from how painful it is when I walk. I walk with a limp today, I never forgot. And you know what? Sadly, I think some people have forgotten how hard it was to break free. And I think for some people, it probably was a lot easier to break free than it was for myself or many others that struggled with a lot of other issues. And I think we're being unfair as well as to assume that a one size approach is going to meet the needs of people that we know nothing about, or what they're dealing with, or what they don't want to deal with. This was a big thing, man. You don't want to listen. Sometimes trauma is one of those things that your body can only absorb so much of it until it starts to impact you negatively, or there's consequences from it. But then there's also that side of you that doesn't want to deal with it because it's too painful of a past to remember. There's so many people out there that struggle with so much abuse, man, that, where it's like, if you give them $10, they're going to do heroin, but it's like, who cares, man? It's like, hey, just use it at the supervised consumption site. It's such a heartbreaking, to hear somebody talk to you about their struggles. And then them not willing to want to deal with it. And I don't blame them. For a lot of times, I don't blame people for not wanting to deal with it. But I always just show up. I waited out That's what I do. I just wait people out. Let people know what exists out there, whether it's harm reduction service, whether it's a recovery community center that you can go to, whether it's a recovery house, inpatient, outpatient, whether it's medications. And every time I see people, I just walk down the street, say hello and talk, you know, talk about detox. I go back to a detox facility. I do a group there with a good friend of mine as well. And, you know, we just try to inspire people. I think, you know, what we've done is we've created this division where we're not inspiring people. We're pointing fingers at people and judging them, and that's shaming them, and that's driving people into isolation. I mean, like, listen, like, you know what? Like, everybody just has to just, it's healthcare, man, and supervised consumption sites are healthcare for people who use drugs.
I keep going back as you're speaking, the starting point piece for where people are sort of entering drug use, I think to me is such an important piece. Like, you take a look at somebody who maybe we in Calgary, we're famous for our cocaine in the 90s, because in the corporate culture there were a lot of people who fell into addiction because of cocaine use, because of the corporate culture that existed. And when you compare, and I'm not saying that those people didn't have background trauma, I'm absolutely not saying that, but when you compare that to some of the people that you've talked about, or you compare that even to your experience, where it is trauma, 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 and there's very little starting point, and you're digging yourself out of that, an entirely different shaped and deep hole. That's a piece of the conversation that I just don't ever see happening. And I'm really grateful that you brought that up, because that, you're going to need a different shovel. You're going to need a different ladder. You're getting, like, everything's different. And it's that starting point piece. You know, it's, I want to get to the policy part. If you had magic wand and you could say, okay, you know what, here's going to be the provincial policy for BC. Maybe you could throw Alberta into the mix, cause boy, we're so screwed over here right now. But if you were gonna write provincial policy, if you were gonna write federal policy, and whatever you said could happen, what would that look like, do you think?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, when you write policy, I think people, you know, are in power, right? And when people write the public holds the power. So when you're writing policy, it's this: you want to remain in power, or you want to make changes? And if you want to make changes, you won't be in power. And so if I could just do it, I mean, I'd start with one substance, the substance that's killing people. And I'd say, hey, we're going to regulate these opioids. And guess what? People can come in and purchase them off out of, like they do with alcohol or cannabis, tobacco. You know, where at least you're competing with what the illicit market is, the unregulated market. Is organized crime going to go away? No. Will they always do what they do? Yes. But we're not even on a level where we can even compete with them. And so that's where people's only option is. Now, even if you listen to this, though, even if you are, people think, oh, you're going to give opioids to intermittent substance user. Where do you think the intermittent substance user is using the opioids? Like, people always talk about these unintended risks that can create more addiction. And I'm like, well, look what's creating death. I mean, I can work with people who struggle with addiction. I can't work with people when they're gone. And so that would be, I'd pick that one, you know, and say, hey, do that for a year, and if it don't work, then, hey, we'll cancel it all. But at least let's give it a shot. Like, I mean, what have we got to lose? Because I'll tell you what we are losing, 6 people each day in this province. I think in Alberta, it's, what, 4 or 5? Yeah. And, two, you guys are far smaller than us. So when you actually think about it, too. And here's another thing, too, where I look at. Listen, nobody complains about people who are using drugs in their homes. Now, we don't even care. If we see it outside, we care. But these people don't have any homes to go use drugs in. And so you're But to everybody else, it's you don't even know when you walk by your neighbor's house down the block, the 25 houses that you pass, there's somebody using drugs in that house somewhere. You don't know, but it doesn't bother you, right? But yet, when people don't have housing or homeless or struggling, we point fingers, judge, shame. It's a whole fleet of circumstances that wound them up there, and it's unfortunate. And so, yeah, that would be my thing, and I would have it where, and hey, I'm not talking about giving drugs for free. I'm talking about, hey, people can come and purchase them. And he purchased them at a level what's on the street, and people will say, oh, well, if it's regulated, then they'll still access the drug market. It's like, maybe, but maybe not. And maybe we'll remove 50,000 from that drug supply where people are having the ability to pick up substances that they know what they're consuming. I tell you, the most empowering thing is knowing what you're consuming. I knew every time I used heroin the amount that I was using. Like I knew the dope so well because I'd bought it my whole life until I didn't know. Until the same amount looked the same, tasted the same, wasn't the same. And I tell you, it's so fast. I don't even remember. People always ask me that question. Did you see anything? Did you feel anything? It's like, no. The only thing I remember is waking up. I don't remember going down. I didn't remember feeling anything. It was just that quick. And you're gone. And guess what? The people who die alone in this province, about 60% die in private residence. There are a lot of people have jobs, people who are struggling. How the language of how we communicate publicly to people who are struggling to use drugs is creating isolation for the people who are struggling. And I think the worst thing for anybody, and the sadness that I always see, is that it's a lonely place to die alone. But not only that, they've been using alone for so long, trying to keep it together, trying to show up for work, trying to show up in people's lives. There's a tremendous amount of shame that goes with this. It's heartbreaking. And not only do I see it from the people who are struggling, I see the family members. Even people who've died of an overdose, their sons or their daughters or their family member, they don't say publicly that they died of an overdose because there's so much shame. I mean, we have to do a better job, man. And we just, it breaks my heart that, I get calls, emails all the time, man, from people asking for help, and I just try to do my best to help people, man. That's it. And everything I have in my life today is, I tell you, is a direct result of just really kind of helping other people. I made a lot of mistakes, painful ones. And I hurt a lot of people. And so how I live my life today is to try to just, be a light in people's lives, whether they're using drugs or want to get off drugs. And that's my way of repaying back society. And I don't want to see my kids struggle or your kids struggle or the next person's kid struggles. And so the big key piece in all of this that's missing or needs to be talked about far more greater is the education of these substances that exist in our society, and they aren't safe. Whether you hear somebody say safer supply, it doesn't mean that you can go out and get them because they're safer. Just because you hear the word safer doesn't mean they're safe. What it means is by telling people education that if you are using these substances, they're very unpredictable. There can be a lot of consequences that come. You could develop an addiction. You might not. You go down the list and you educate people and you give them the information and inform them. And I tell you, I go do talks in high schools, 14-year-old kids. I have parents that call me after their kid comes home. They can't even get their kid to ever talk about school, but yet I go in to do a talk and they want to talk about drugs, Which is really interesting. And parents need to be up to date and educated as well, because if you're not going to educate your kids, guess what? They're going to learn somewhere. My parents never told me anything about drugs. I saw the destruction of alcohol in my family. Nobody told me about drugs on the street. Oh, maybe the dare, the police told me that I'd be arrested if I was using drugs. But it was funny because I was already using drugs when the DARE program came out. So I was like, hey, doesn't this guy know we're all high right now? So just how we portray things for so long has really put us, stigma has become just as deadly as the drugs themselves, and it's created this isolation. And sadly, this is why people use alone and die because of it.
One of the things that I always go to with the safe supply piece is I remember growing up, and you'd hear these stories. Maybe some people experienced them firsthand. Not saying, but you'd have somebody who they'd go and buy a joint from somewhere, and it would be laced with something, and they'd have these adverse effects. And I mean, I don't mind saying, I remember one time where when years and years and years ago, I got my hands on a joint from a friend, somebody that I trusted, and I spent I don't know how much time after that watching my eyeballs roll around in my lap on the couch, terrified of what would happen if they rolled onto the floor, because the apartment that I was in, that person had a cat, and how do you clean cat hair off of an eyeball? It was a really distressing situation. But since the legalization and regulation of marijuana, I can't think of an example where I've heard in the media, through social media, anything, where somebody said, hey, Timmy was smoking a joint and XYZ happened. You know what I mean? So I think that there's proof of concept of you can avoid a lot of the, not all, because you're absolutely right. There's no such thing as safe supply. Anytime somebody's using, there's certainly risk associated. But I think that you can avoid a lot of the surprise risks that exist, like you experienced when you were talking about the first time that you were exposed to fentanyl, just by regulating and making accessible a regulated supply. I'm curious, you're being so generous with your time, and I really don't want to push my luck, but what would you say, like Danielle Smith, Premier of Alberta, she did an interview recently where she was asked about safe supply, and without providing any reason, and the interviewer actually held her to task quite nicely on it in some ways. But Danielle Smith flat out said that Alberta would absolutely not, under her watch, consider any form of safer supply, and that harm reduction was not going to be involved in the Alberta model that's increasingly becoming known worldwide for all of the wrong reasons. What would you want Danielle Smith to hear or understand about what she's got wrong?
Well, just like I educate anybody, is that, I wouldn't have over a decade sober. It gave me the ability to keep me alive. My kids wouldn't be alive today. If that supervised consumption site didn't, I wouldn't have three beautiful children. I wouldn't live the life that I have today. And, I think she has to understand that going into treatment doesn't guarantee that people are going to remain sober for the rest of their lives. And that's why we need a harm reduction safety net underneath that. And people need access, just like they need timely access to recovery and detox and treatment. They need timely access to harm reduction services, safer supply services. Whether that's a heroin program or an IHOP program, it's like, listen, if people want to show up to go to get these substances, then listen, they're already using the toxic street drugs. Our job as human beings are to try to help human beings. And we have to do everything to do that. Not just one, there's not one size is going to fit all. The unfortunate thing is that, like I said, there's no guarantee in going to recovery. And there's no guarantee with using street drugs. And there's no guarantee with harm reduction facilities. But what there is a guarantee is that people will always remember how you made them feel when you have those places available for them to access the service. And that's the part where I describe walking into a harm reduction service for me was I almost maybe I when I when I laugh about it now, but I would have the theme song of Cheers playing through my head. Sometimes you just want to go where everybody knows your name. And they were glad you came. And I think that's how the relationships gets built. And you can do both of those in Alberta. And in BC, we have a recovery systems of care in place, and we have harm reduction in place. But we still haven't been able to remove people from the illicit drug supply. So it doesn't matter what you have. You can go all in on everything that you want to go in, but if it doesn't remove people from the illicit drug supply, then they will continue to die. And we have to understand that if we don't give an alternative to that, that's viable for people to choose from. And I'm not saying everybody is going to choose that, but there will be people that will. And whether I keep somebody alive where they've accessed a safer supply service and it's for 10 years until they get into treatment or recovery that they want to go in, then what's wrong with that? It doesn't mean that just because I went and I got it the first time or I got it when I was 43, doesn't make me any less of a person. I think you have to encourage people, inspire people, show up for people even when they are using substances. And if we do that, then you know what? Then once people, there's a trust factor. And I think how things are portrayed publicly through governments, people lack trust. The healthcare system has failed substance users for decades. Like for decades. We haven't even been able to repair that. You wonder why people don't want to go? Well, guess what? When I'd overdosed in the hospital, and they kick you out at 3 in the morning with no place to go, no services open. And I told them I couldn't go anywhere, and security came and threw me out onto the sidewalk. That's how people were treated. And does that exist today? Sure. It still does. People are still judgmental that you're a drug user using drugs on the street. And it doesn't keep people there. Sure, they may be struggling with addiction. They may need to go to treatment. But the reality is that if they don't want to go, then we can't just turn our backs on them because somebody doesn't want to do something that we're trying to do. We have to be supportive of them. And if we have that full continuum of care, we'll save a lot of lives.
Do you have time for one more question?
I do, yes.
Okay, thank you. You talked about the difference between why people use certain substances. If you were looking for that euphoria, you would go more with the sympathomimetic, the uppers or whatever. And the hook of opiates is that if you become dependent on them, being dope sick is so unbelievably brutal. Like, people use the term dope sick and it makes it sound like, oh, you got a little bit of a flu. But that really understates the severity of, simply going through detoxing from an opiate can be lethal. That's just the reality. We have in the province of Alberta right now a premier and a chief of staff and a deputy premier who are all advocating for forced treatment. And their argument is if somebody's overdosing on opiates multiple times a day, then they do not have the ability to make decisions on their own. And it's no different than issuing what in Alberta we call a Form 10, which is where somebody is determined to be non-copus mentis. The evidence seems to be very clear. Forced treatment doesn't work. For all of the reasons that you've very clearly hit on today, what would you like Danielle Smith, Mike Ellis, and Marshall Smith to hear based on your lived experience, not just your personal lived experience, but with your experience with people that you work with? What would you want them to hear about forced treatment, particularly forced treatment for opiates?
Well, that it's not going to work out well, that's for sure. And honestly, there's not, I don't think there's a bunch of people who are overdosing multiple times a day either. Sure, some are. I've heard stories where people were trying to tell me that they were overdosing 5, 6 times a day. I said, there's not much that much hours in a day for somebody to keep overdosing. So forcing anybody into something that they don't want to do. How's that going to look about, listen, so say you have a treatment facility, right? And you pick a guy like me off the street that's out of, and you say, hey, we're going to force you into treatment. And I'm going to be like, oh yeah, you are, right? And I'm going to go into treatment with a bunch of people may that want to be there. And I'm going to be that disruptive kind of guy that's in treatment that just does not care and tells the treatment facility, kick me out because I'm not doing your program. What are you going to do? Like, what are you going to do? You're going to keep me there? Like, you're going to keep me there against my own will? How's that going to work? And how's that therapeutic? That doesn't even sound like anything that's like client-centered. That's government-centered. That's a policy centering. That's not a person-centered. And guess what's going to happen is that you're going to, what I'd like to see, I mean, I just don't think it's possible to even happen because I think it would be challenged as well. Listen, if somebody goes and commits crimes, and I'm not talking if it's because of their drug use, and say somebody's going to go do 3 years in prison, and then you come in and say, hey, instead of going to 3 years in prison, do you want to go to, we can offer you this facility to go to. Then let the person choose. That is, I am in support of that. But I'd rather go, I'm telling you, and I've had the option. I've had judges say to me in court, guy, you want to go to treatment? No, I don't. I didn't want to go at that time. Jail became so familiar for me anyway. It was like sock change. I didn't care if I went to jail. I didn't care if I was out on the street. I didn't care if I went to jail. I was that guy that really just didn't care until I, realized that this is not who I want to be. And that took a long time and a lot of battling, a lot of demons. And so you're trying to force people to do something that they're not ready to do. How do you think that's going to turn out?
I'm going to go with not well.
Not well at all.
Guy, this has been, I can't even call it like much of a conversation because I think I asked like three questions and the rest of it, I just kind of sat back and listened to you speak. And it has been both a privilege and an honor to do that because I mean, not only is your story incredibly powerful, but the passion with which you speak about the ongoing issues and the toxic supply and the importance of the person-centered approach to treatment, I think is so critically important for people to hear. I think all too often we deal with these conversations in comfortable abstracts, and that makes it comfortable because we lose sight of the humanity, but we lose sight of the humanity. And your whole, everything that you've said today has been just dripping with humanity. And it's been quite the privilege to be able to have this conversation and listen to you speak, sir. I want to say thank you so much.
Anytime, my friend. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure. Honestly, always.
Thank you. And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, we would love nothing more than if you thought about signing up to be one of our Patreon sponsors at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab, where for just the price of a fancy cup of coffee a month, you can help us continue to produce this kind of content. Whether you're listening to the audio version of the podcast, in which case, maybe leave a review and a rating, or whether you're watching it on one of our streaming platforms, we want to say a big thank you to everybody who is part of The Breakdown's audience. And as always, take care of each other and keep the conversation going.